very happy to participate in this conference celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of Hayek. And I'm not going to speak very long, although you should always be suspicious when an academic says that. My experience is they speak three times as long as when we think they're going to speak. But I am really going to try to be brief, because I only want to make a few points. One, I may be the only person in this room, but there may be some others, who was a student of Hayek's at the University of Chicago. So let me give a very brief discussion of that. Now, I can't say I was a close student of Hayek, so it'll be brief for that reason as well. Hayek was in the Committee on Social Thought when I was a graduate student in economics. Now, the Committee on Social Thought is a great place, but it was kind of interesting that he did not have a joint appointment in the economics department. I don't know the full history of that because I was only a graduate student, but my impression is that the department had refused to give him a joint appointment. And the Milton Friedman would know better than I do the ins and outs of that. But I think that's an interesting point to recognize. As a result of not being in the economics department, his contact with economic students was really minimal. He did teach one course, I believe, that was jointly offered as part of the economics program on the history of economic thought, but not many people at that time, not many of us students, were interested in the history of thought and didn't take, and I certainly didn't take that course. But I did learn, and I don't know how I learned, that Hayek was running an evening seminar that would be open to faculty and students. And so I began to attend that seminar, and that was a great experience. Every year there was a different subject. The one year was on psychology. He was writing this book on psychology. Another year would be on something else I can't remember. But the year that sticks out most in my mind was the year it was on methodology, and methodology in different subjects. And so Hayek's general procedure in running that seminar was not to dominate the seminar or to give all the lectures. Actually, generally, he gave few of the lectures. It was mainly to invite other people, largely from around the university, to lecture. And so the year on the seminar, he had Fermi come in and lecture on methodology in physics. And I remember Fermi saying something like, well, if we call that a cat and that a dog, that's theory. He was talking about theory in physics, and classification, in other words, was part of the theory. And he went on to give a stimulating lecture. And for me, of course, it was very exciting to hear Fermi lecture. And then Sewell Wright, a great geneticist, then on the faculty of the University of Chicago, came in. And the bottom line that I came out with from his talk was that all of social and physical and biological science was biology, that somehow the biological way of looking at it was encompassed everything, and that one just had to appreciate that fact. There was also a stimulating lecture, but it was a little confusing, having heard that physics was pretty dominant, now to hear that biology was. And then Milton Friedman came in. At that time, he was working on, and he was a fairly regular participant in the seminar. So when I say came in, some of these people attended regularly. But he gave a talk on methodology and economics. And it was basically the work he did that became so famous on economic methodology. And I found it very persuasive, but I do remember how he was attacked strongly by a lot of people in the audience. I don't know what field. They certainly weren't from the economics department, because I didn't recognize them, on, well, this is positivism, and this isn't the way to do methodology, and so on. And being a second year or so graduate student, it left me a little bit confused, because it seemed pretty obvious and persuasive to me that he had the right, this was the right way to look at things, but apparently not. And so Hayek, of course, in this seminar, as in others, interjected. He was gentle, did not try to dominate the seminar, but interjected remarks, allowed anybody, even students, to speak, although very few of us had the courage at that time to speak. I didn't have many personal contacts with Hayek, but I'll tell one. I've always found it strange. I had written a paper on an economic approach to political democracy. And it was the end of my first year as a graduate student. I thought it was kind of interesting. And I was thinking who around Chicago might comment on that paper. And, well, one was Milton Friedman. I gave it to Friedman. He thought it was quite interesting. Aaron Director was another, who was in law school. I gave it to Director. And then I figured, well, of course, Hayek would be a natural person to comment on it. So I brought it up to Hayek, who was actually across from where my office is now on the fifth floor. And he took one look at it, and he said very nicely, "I'm sorry I don't read handwritten manuscripts." So I didn't type at the time. And I'd written it out very carefully and was very disappointed that he wouldn't look at it and never again showed it to him, because I eventually did submit it to a journal of General Political Economy, where Frank Knight didn't like it and they rejected it for that reason. It was a loss for me that I never got Hayek's reaction. And to this day, I'm not sure whether he would have been sympathetic to Knight, or who disliked it very much, or sympathetic to Schumpeter, because it was really influenced a lot by Schumpeter, a fellow Austrian who I presume Schumpeter would have liked it, since it was following up Schumpeter. And Hayek, I don't know. So in a nutshell, my contact with Hayek as a graduate student was far more than other graduate students in economics. He had very little interaction with the graduate students, and I gather very little interaction with the faculty in economics at Chicago. Whether he had much more with the Social Thought Committee, I don't know. He had a few students. The Letwins were his students at the time, Chiaki Nishiyama, and a few others, although I don't think he had a great number of students in social thought at that time. Now let me, the other comments I wanted to make, and this may duplicate what other people say, is at least my view on Hayek's contributions. And I'll try to be brief, although one can, of course, spend more than one conference on this subject. And there were two Hayeks, really. As I look at it, there were two Hayeks. There was a Hayek who was brought to the London School of Economics for the rigor of his thinking in economic theory, brought by Lionel Robbins, I believe, it was a different tradition than the British tradition in economics, and was brought as a theorist, fundamentally. And in the early 30s, Hayek wrote The Prices and Production, and wrote a book, I think it was called The Pure Theory of Capital. I may be wrong. Neither of these books, in my judgment, nor his work in this area, in my judgment, had a major influence on economics. Okay, so where does Hayek's justly important influence come from? I think it's two areas. I'll come back to the theory in a moment, because I think there were important theoretical contributions there. One, obviously, in public policy. Hayek was the most influential thinker on certainly liberal political and economic philosophy, in my judgment, of the century. Had an enormous influence, more probably outside of economics than among professional economists. The various think tanks in the world. Unfortunately, I missed Ralph Harris's. What I heard was a very stimulating presentation, and I wish I had heard it, but a great influence on this in Eastern Europe, in young people prior to going into economics, stimulating to go into economics, enormous influence, and I think really helped turn the public policy and the world around. So that influence alone would justifiably give Hayek a lasting position in the catalog of great thinkers. But it was surprisingly really little influence within the profession, in my judgment. And if you ask, well, what in sort of thinking on policy directly does one attribute to Hayek, I don't think it's a large subset. But his influence was much broader than that, and I think much more important than that. And that was substantial. Now, within the profession, Hayek, I think, did do very important theoretical work, although not the work that I mentioned on either prices on production, which was business cycles, or on Austrian capital theory. I link his contribution to where he went in his disagreement with the socialists. Hayek, following up on, I guess, his teacher von Mises, argued, and what we now know correctly so, that there was a basic flaw in the socialist model of organizing an economic system, and that the view that it could be easily done, and this was a view that many outstanding economic theorists were promoting at that time, Oscar Lange, Paul Samuelson, and others, that somehow they could solve the same equations that a competitive system solves. That was not an uncommon view. It wasn't common at Chicago, I would say, but it was a common view in the profession. Hayek argued, no, that it couldn't be done. And the question then became, well, what was the basic flaw in the socialist model, even in the sort of market socialists? There was a group in the 30s what they called themselves market socialists, Oscar Lange, Abelerna, and others, who argued that, in a sense, socialism could do things better than capitalism by following more closely the capitalist model. So that if you sort of told each of the public enterprises to sort of equate costs, what we call in economics marginal cost to price, and you set prices appropriately, and you set wages equal to their productivity, then you could have all the benefits of a competitive system without having to worry about the what they considered the inequitable distribution of income. You could separate effectively the organization of production from the distribution of proceeds. That was the goal of socialists. Lange, Lerner, and others thought they had a way of doing it that would do better than a capitalist system. Hayek was a leader in coming along and say that couldn't be done. And basically, the way I will interpret what he did was he argued it couldn't be done because of the weak incentive structure in a socialist system. And in particular, he emphasized that a socialist system couldn't integrate the diverse and spread knowledge that different participants had in an economic system, couldn't effectively get these people to reveal it to the central authority who supposedly was going to give us this efficient planning. He was explicitly highly critical of Schumpeter. If you read his article in the American Economic Review on this, highly critical of Schumpeter and others who argue that this could be done. And he didn't use, I don't think he used the word incentive. So basically it's saying what was the incentive they had to reveal this information that, say, somebody out there in the fields of Iowa is... comes up with, has some knowledge about hybrids. Why would he or she have any incentive to reveal it to the central authority? Okay. He went on to argue that the price system integrates knowledge. So that's the great contribution of a price system set flexibly, that people have an incentive then to reveal this knowledge because they gain profits by buying cheap and selling high, so to speak, the goal of every person, every business person. It is to buy cheap and sell high, and prices, as they buy cheap, they bid up prices. As they sell high, they lower prices. And it's a price system that's revealing this knowledge. So Hayek's, I think, the great contribution was this emphasis on this incentive structure, and it's still an issue that has not been fully articulated in economics. People have discovered Hayek, realized Hayek was there and pointing this out, how to fully integrate this integration of knowledge and the giving people the right incentives to accumulate knowledge is an ongoing enterprise in economics. But when Hayek wrote, it was Hayek, I would say, more or less alone speaking about this enterprise. This was not an issue that most economic theorists or other economists thought was a major focus, was a major part of an economic problem. That should be a major focus of economic analysts. And there's no question Hayek was right. If you now in 45, 55 years later, since he wrote this piece in the American Economic Review, it's clear Hayek was absolutely right about that. The knowledge problem is an essential problem. It's becoming more and more a serious and important problem rather than less and less, because we're becoming more and more a knowledge-based economy, where how well economies invest in knowledge and organize knowledge and utilize in the aggregate knowledge is a crucial determinant. Modern economies have an enormous amount of knowledge in the aggregate, but it pieces together the individual specialized knowledge of millions of people. That's what the problem that Hayek saw, and he said, well, how do you get this integration? That is, I think, if not the economic problem, it's one of the small number of crucial economic problems for determining whether economies grow or decline, whether they stagnate. And while Hayek did not, in this article or in his later work, have all the answers to it, we still don't have all the answers to it. But he set out the problem, I think gave some of the solutions to that. And I think if he had done nothing else, he would be remembered as having made a major, major contribution to economic theory. He did more than that. He made major contributions to economic policy. And it's on those grounds that I personally rank Hayek as one of the great economists of the century. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One of the many people who suggested that the committee and the Liberty Fund ultimately do a conference on Hayek was the Austrian consul to the United States here in Chicago, a man named Dr. Krepala. And when I started to ask around about this phase of Hayek's career in so-called the School of Austrian Economics, and many people told me that Professor Leuba was the person to invite, the Austrian consul was ecstatic, because not only is he an expert on Austrian economics, he is an Austrian expert on Austrian economics, and that seemed only fitting given Hayek's background. Professor Leuba is many things all over the world. He is professor in the Department of Economics at Cal State Hayward. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's the professor and academic director of the International Institute for Austrian Economics, the director of a Hayek Institute in Vienna, and of another institute in Turin. He's the ultimate international academic, for many of us the most enviable kind of position to be in, to have jobs in Vienna, Turin, California, and elsewhere. Professor Leuba is a historian of economic thought with an emphasis on Austrian economics and a scholar of law and economics and economic philosophy. His many books include The Essence of Schumpeter in 1996, Die Österreichische Schule der Nationalökonomie in 1995, The Essence of Friedman, these next three will be familiar to many of you, The Essence of Friedman, The Essence of Stigler, and The Essence of Hayek. So it's only fitting that he be here with us today at the University of Chicago, Professor Kurt Leuba.
Thank you very much for the nice words and nice introduction. Let me divide my remarks into two things. First, I should say that since Lenin once observed that one cannot really properly understand Karl Marx without studying, it's probably for you, Georg Wilhelm Hegel, I guess we can say no one really understands Hayek without studying the background of the Austrian School of Economics and his development within that school. Therefore, I will divide that into two major things. First, I will talk a little bit about the development of the Austrian School of Economics within the context of the Austrian philosophy. And then I will talk, according to my title, the legacy of Hayek, I believe, or Hayek's legacy, it really doesn't matter, on Hayek's legacy and what he had to say. First, let me start to say that until 1820, roughly, most books by Thomas Hobbes or David Hume or John Locke, or if you like, Rousseau, and even Adam Smith were prohibited in Austria until 1820. That means, in other words, until that time, there was no reception of these ideas of the Enlightenment, and therefore, of course, the Austrian social philosophy or the development of the philosophy would fall incredibly behind. In other words, the political weakness of, say, ideas usually associated with free markets throughout the Habsburg Empire were completely ignored until 1820. Only afterwards, in the so-called Vormärz, it developed a little bit in the works of Franz Brentano and Bernhard von Bolzano, by the way, a relative of mine, a long way ago. And, of course, by the so-called Austrian Cameralists. These were a small group of people who, for the first time, associated the thinking of the individual with what they call causal genetic action. That was a term which, by the way, played then a major role in the development of the Austrian School of Economics, especially after the publication of Karl Menger's famous book, The Principles of Economics. Further, I should mention, just as an introduction, that the textbooks used in the Austrian universities were, of course, dominated by ideas announced by statists. I give you just a couple of names. There were books by Franz Kudler, no one can understand that anymore, Hugeland, Rau, and others, who dominated the market for textbooks. In other words, indoctrinating one generation after another of the students in their idea, what they called, let me quote, Polizeiwissenschaft, the science of police. That was the title for economics. Then we can say that after the ideas of Kudler, Rau, and others began to fail, and we were all confronted with that bourgeoisie revolution of the late 1840s, to be precise, 1848, when more or less all of the Habsburg Empire was aflame, and especially Vienna was turned over by the bourgeois and others. Only afterwards, the censorship somewhat was lifted. That was the beginning when Karl Menger, although the book was already done, were contemplating publishing it, because before that time, it was not possible to publish that book. Two other things played a major role, namely the Battle of 1866 between Austria, the Empire, and the Prussian Empire. Austria lost bitterly. And the reason why they lost bitterly was, of course, because a friend of Karl Menger suggested in 1865 to the Emperor Franz Joseph at that particular time to exchange the muscle loader loading rifles with a carabine thing, a rapid firing thing, which he invented. It was called the Mannlicher Stutzen, the Mannlicher rifle. Conservative as he, the emperor, was, of course, flatly denied that. And, of course, the reason was then a major defeat of the Austrians, who had to stand up, load their rifles, and, of course, were a major target for the Prussians, who had adapted that rapid-firing thing and, of course, eliminated the armies of the Austrian Empire. There was an even more important thing, namely, under the defeat and under the bourgeois revolution, of course, in 1867, Austria, for the first time in its 1,000 years of history, got some sort of a constitution. That constitution, of course, played a major role in the liberation of people people all of a sudden had the freedom to do that or that and so on and so forth. And you can certainly see that, especially whenever you visit Vienna. The splendor of Vienna began, or is actually, the result of an incredible investment boom following 1867. You can see that. So, in other words, the time was now ripe for Karl Menger, and he, in 1871, published his Grundsätze, which was immediately ignored, totally ignored, I should say. Only one relatively sincere review was published, and that review thoroughly misunderstood his points. However, the point, what he tried to make, was, of course, important. Namely, he developed the theory of subjective value. For me, it is not only the marginal revolution which played a major role in the development of the Austrian School of Economics. Much more important for me was that the subjective nature of human choice began to really play a role. Therefore, out of that idea and out of the approach of Menger, we certainly can see a close and very tightly knit development of what we now call, following Schumpeter, the methodological individualism. Let me quote Hayek. About the middle of the last century, subjectivism came into its own, as it was gradually realized that human that human ingenuity can overcome the obstacles presented by the classical forces, the human mind, and its manifestations, choice, and decisions came to occupy the center of the economic stage. The subjective revolution of the 1870s presents only one aspect of the change, but it epitomizes it well. It came to be realized that the value of a good does not reside in any measurable properties it might have, but constitutes a relationship between an appraising mind and the good, unquote. That was the very beginning of what we, as I said, what we following Schumpeter call the methodological individualism. Karl Menger's methodological dualism, I should call it, has fundamentally and thoroughly influenced all members of the Austrian School of Economics. This insight that human beings and their actions must be investigated and analyzed with a methodology that sharply and fundamentally differs from the methods used in the natural sciences is truly crucial. That is the beginning of the Austrian School of Economics. If I may say, we can certainly argue that Karl Menger became the first generation. Of course, he was a monopolist in that respect. But his book, although completely ignored, however, was spread out. And one of the reasons why it was spread out was, of course, that he was appointed the tutor of the Crown Prince Rudolf of the Habsburg Empire to teach him good economics. He was not appointed by the emperor, but he was appointed behind the back of the emperor by the Empress of Austria. Hayek indoctrinated that young, apparently very clever, crown prince for closely 5 years, cross-examination and everything else, and helped, of course, because the word was spread, to spread out the ideas of Austrian economics into wider circles. The second generation, therefore, grew slowly and developed slowly in Vienna. All of a sudden, although Vienna until, as I already said, until the 1850s was considered desert for intellectual, social, economic, intellectual ambitions, all of a sudden became really a haven for all people from the vast empire. They all flocked into Vienna. The second generation, which played, of course, a major role in order to get the word out, was predominantly staffed by people in the so-called bureaucracy, funnily enough. Bernd Babak, of course, everyone knows his name, for associated with capital theory and other things, was, and that should not be hidden, three times in a row, the imperial minister for financial affairs. Whenever he didn't get his will, he quit. But since people didn't have an alternative, they always called him back. So in other words, three times in a row, he was made minister for financial affairs. Friedrich von Wieser, another major head of the Austrian School of Economics, was made the minister for foreign affairs in a very brief period, and secondly, then the minister for commerce and exchange rates, whatever that might be. It is important to mention here that although Menger's ideas became relatively important in all over the Austrian Empire, it was still totally ignored in Germany as well as in the German-speaking part of Switzerland. They immediately caught fire, apparently, and opposed the Mengerian idea to say that we are talking about the individual decision-making and not a collective bargaining system. Menger did not publish a lot because he had other things to do, but in 1883 he published another major book, namely Problems of Economics and Sociology, probably even more influential than his first Grundsätze or the Principles. That book was not ignored. It caused and unleashed the so-called Methodenstreit, the struggle over methods between the younger German historical school led by Gustav von Schmoller and, of course, the Austrian School of Economics, which already was somewhat established in Vienna. Gustav von Schmoller argued that we can only make economics work if we collect data from past experiences, and continued to say that only by that technique we can resolve economic problems of all kinds. Menger, on the in the opposition, said, of course, the collective exists only of individuals, and only individuals count. So in other words, he argued that the Austrian School of Economics did not engage in any collective approaches, but they approached that thing from an individual background. The group became larger and larger, and I just give you a couple of names because they seem to me at least quite important. Emil Sachs, you probably have not heard about him. However, he was the person who really anticipated the European Union in a very interesting way, especially with his collaboration with the Crown Prince Rudolf in terms of determining some sort of a constitution for the so-called River Danube Association of Countries. There was another person, namely Johannes Komorzynski, who long before Mises anticipated the impossibility of calculations within the socialist system. That was Komorzynski. There was another person from Prague, at that time part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Franz Tschuhel, who determined or developed a complete theory of desires, which began then to play a major role in influencing Sigmund Freud and the whole psychoanalytical school of in Vienna. So it was quite an interesting crowd who oscillated around Karl Menger and Bernd Babak and Friedrich von Wieser. That was the second generation. The third generation, of course, then derived and developed within a so-called seminar, which he, Bernd Babak, conducted at the University of Vienna between 1904 and 1914, immediately after he died. That seminar was quite an interesting thing. An enormously diverse group of people attended that. I just give you a couple of names. Lenin, not permanently, but sometimes. Mises, of course. Schumpeter. Kelsen, the father of legal positivism. Richard von Strigel, Amon, and I could go on with 32 other names. They all, at one time or another, attended the famous Böhm-Barberg seminar, where he tried to really establish an Austrian system. That was his ambition, which he permanently stated in the introductions of his interest theory, capital theory, and the rest of it. Menger, or the reason I should say, why Böhm-Barberg became such a highlight in the academic circles of Vienna was because very prematurely Karl Menger quit his teaching position in 1903 following a gigantic scandal. And this gigantic scandal turned out to be nowadays, 1999, not at all a scandal. The reason was that he had, let me say, a little bit sloppily, produced a child with his maintenance personnel. And that was Karl Menger Jr., who lived here in Chicago and died in 1984. That was Karl Menger Jr. That was the reason why he had to quit and left the university. Unfortunately, it was taken over then. Unfortunately, but it was taken over, as I said, by a congenial group of people whom I already discussed. It is therefore somewhat curious that out of that seminar, the Böhm-Barberg seminar, Schumpeter himself, a member of that famous seminar, developed ideas which are much more closely associated with the Lausanne School than anything which resembles the Austrian School of Economics. So Schumpeter was quite an interesting person who then, together with Mises, of course, for certain political, racist, and whatnot reasons, has been ignored in order to get a chair in one of the Austrian universities or universities in the Crownlands. And therefore, the fourth generation developed therefore outside the university. Let me repeat: Mises, and I will talk about that in a minute. Mises was never offered a regular professorship at any of the universities in good old Austria. None. Schumpeter was made Minister of Finance. Ruined the currency within 60 days, which is world record, and then, of course, was more or less lauded off to Bonn in Germany, where he then did something else and then escaped to Harvard. All others did not get a position for, as I said, I would say political, but hard to say, nevertheless, it's true for racial reasons. Mises, therefore, tried to conduct his seminar outside the university. And I should talk a little bit about the intellectual environment of Austria in the years immediately following the First World War. The universities were more or less closed because of lack of heating material. Universities were mainly occupied by socialists who won over immediately after the breakdown of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, obviously clear, not only in Austria but elsewhere. Austria was cut off from its crown lands. You should not forget that Austria proper was just a tiny little thing, which is probably not even exceeding the size of Lake Michigan here. But before the First World War, it was a gigantic empire which could recruit from all over the places, and all of a sudden it was gone. In other words, These people therefore found refuge somewhere else. Mises, in order to make some sort of a living, joined the Chamber of Commerce in Vienna and conducted their biweekly seminar, to which he invited all, as he called it, promising students, which he spied around from the university. That is an interesting thing, but I will talk about that in a minute. The second development was, of course, the psychoanalytical society, Freud, Adler, and others. A third important group of the intellectual development of that time was the so-called Geistkreis, or the, how can I translate that? Help me. Geistkreis, forget it, it's Geistkreis. It's Geistkreis meaning something to do with mental alertness. Anyway, that was the Geistkreis, and there was a so-called economic society, which really played the most important role because most bureaucrats were joined that group. They developed then the later on the Austrian Business Cycle Research Institute only as a bureaucratic thing, and in order to give Hayek a job because he couldn't get another possibility, and many others. Among them, of course, the very influential and very important group of philosophers, which we call the Vienna Circle, not cycle. They should be recycled, but they are a circle. It's a different thing. So the point is, the point where what I'm trying to make is that all these intellectual developments took place outside the university, and that is important. In other words, the development of the fourth generation of the Austrian School of Economics, of which Hayek was most certainly the leading and the most pronounced person, took place in Mises' seminar. I'll just give you a couple of names, who were all good Mont-Pelerin Society members: Gottfried von Habeler, Fritz Machlup, Martha Stephanie Brown, and you name it. I could go on with roughly 132 people. It's just amazing how Mises was able to attract students from all over. By the way, there were even people from the United States who really put on the pain to go to Europe just to sit in Mises' seminar, John von Sickle, for instance, and others. Morgenstern played a major role there, of course, in developing his own ideas. Mises influenced all of them, there's absolutely no doubt. He influenced Hayek very, very consistently and very dramatically. However, I should now come closer to my actual title, Where's the Hayek Legacy Now? And I can say that there was a Caesar, there was some break between the relationship between Hayek and Mises. But first, let me talk about Hayek's developments, which were really playing a major role. In 1927, he built up that Institute for Business Cycle Research. Actually, it did. Mises did it in order to give Hayek a job because he could not find anything which paid for his family, young family, and for his expenses. In 1929, he published his first book, The Business Cycle and Monetary Theory, in German, of course. It was translated, I believe, a little bit later in the 1930s. As far as I can judge, not really getting to the gist of the idea, the English translation seems to me, at least with all due respect, of course, not that great. 1931, he published Prices and Production, immediately following his invitation by Lord Robbins, former Lionel Robbins, at the London School of Economics, but we have heard that. The development did already take place of Hayek's specific approach when he spent quite a few very important month at the University of Zurich in the winter months between 1919 and 1920. Rahi, for the first time, was exposed to Moritz Schlick, and he was exposed, of course, then to the ideas of his second great cousin, Ludwig Wittgenstein. And all of a sudden, he drafted already a piece, which he, and you already mentioned that, published here in Chicago some 32 years later, namely The Sensory Order. I'm in the possession of his draft, and I can tell you it is actually the original book. It is absolutely amazing that a person just 20 years of age could draft that thing. Certainly under the influence of Ludwig Wittgenstein, and you see the determination of in the book is a typical Wittgenstein thing. Anyway, he laid his groundwork of the use of knowledge in society, which Gary already elaborated so well on, and I can skip a little bit. But that idea of the so-called sensory order was already leading to that thing. In 1936, already quite established at the London School of Economics, I shouldn't say established in the term, in the sense of having built a school around him. That was not the case, and it was never the case with Hayek. But at least he was established as he was the Tuck professor for, I believe it was called, statistics and economic science. And then as a president of the Economics Reform Club, he developed a paper called Economics and Knowledge, which was, of course, foreshadowing the ideas of the use of knowledge in society. Here, and that is, for me, the funny part, and I knew Mises quite well, and he told me that he did not really appreciate that thing as a criticism of his position, although Hayek told me, on the other hand, a little bit afterwards, that it was intended a major criticism of Mises' point. Mises, and I really paraphrase, of course, in a very brief way, Mises made it clear throughout his work that he believes in the existence of a priori markets. Markets, for him, are a priori there. They are existing. And out of the existing a priori idea, we certainly then interpret these things accordingly and lead them then in certain categorization. Hayek, following his own sensory order, of course, made a completely different approach. And that approach was quite interesting. In his sensory order, in his original sensory order, the draft I talked about, he made it clear that all of us, the individuals, are trying to categorize things according to our previously received sensations, which is, of course, in the meantime, fairly accepted. But at that particular time, it was not accepted, especially if you read, for instance, Kluber's idea, Freud's ideas, and others, it was certainly not accepted. Hayek meant by categorizing these things only saying that the individuals, or all individuals, are doing nothing but maximizing their well-being. In other words, what they are doing is they act because, or in the expectation, to be better off than otherwise. That's the whole propelling reason, for Hayek at least, the propelling reason why people act in the first place. What they do afterwards might be regret or may be something else. But at any rate, the idea of the sensory order is that people, all people, act according to the so-called maximizing principle. Now, that has, of course, some quite important impacts on his criticism of Mises. Mises, let me repeat, thought that markets are a priori here. Hayek only argued the logic of choice, which is, of course, the maximizing principle, is developing markets. Markets, therefore, under no condition can have certain directions, nor would have markets any purpose. There is no purpose. Only we, the individual, are using the markets in order to maximize our purposes. That was not really properly understood by Mises, as I said, as his criticism, or as Hayek's criticism vis-à-vis him. On the other hand, that approach to the brand new approach in the Austin School of Economics really shaped the whole development of the Austin School of Economics. It is quite an interesting thing to compare, for instance, the literature of the followers of the fourth generation of the Austin School of Economics after Hayek published that thing. Before, they completely were Misesians. Even Habila or Machlup and Martha Stephanie Brown and all others. Afterwards, they developed into a more Hayekian approach. It is, as I said, quite consistent with his ideas developed already in the Sands Reorder. His second approach, which he announced there in the development of the use of knowledge in society, which, as Gary pointed out already, was only published in 1945, but the economics and knowledge piece was already more or less laying down the groundwork, where he established then a very interesting idea, which I, without any hesitation, would say is one of his original ideas, although he did not really establish that verbatim. He distinguished between understanding and what we call conceptualizing, the distinction between, to use German words, verstehen and begreifen. Begreifen meaning the conceptualization of things. Understanding, it's verstehen, of course, meaning understanding. There is a major difference here. Not a single person before, within the Austrian School of Economics, and I'm very confined here, did distinguish that so-called interdependency of economic actions. And interesting enough, it was another person whom we ought to celebrate this year, namely Wilhelm Röpke, who was born exactly 100 years ago, as we all know, really took that on and talked about the interdependencies of orders. That was actually then the idea when the ordo-liberal school, if I may say so, and the Austrian School of Economics really merged to some degree, only for a brief period of time. The methods he, Hayek, and the Austrian School of Economics afterwards used were, of course, called, or he called it, I should say, composite methods, whereas the methods of the natural sciences were clearly called analytical, following certain Cassirers and other people from the Vienna circle. The idea of Begreifen und Verstehen is that thing what the Austrian School of Economics, unfortunately, I really have to admit that, called in a very confusing way, the praxeological cognition. That is a term, of course, which does not really catch fire. No one really understands what we are meaning, but it is very simple. It is only the acceptance of Hayek's idea that markets are not a priori, only after the action of people we develop markets. That was the thing. So in other words, all that is gained through the application of Begreifen und Verstehen, to use these terms in lack of something better, because the conceptualization as the translation of Begreifen is not really adequate, is only that we relate the things to all different maximizing principles of the other people. In other words, it stems, or it comes out, or it follows, to be precise, that since all people have not the same, but a principle, namely the maximizing principle, it certainly determines that we have to give them some sort of a framework within that they should be allowed to develop their different value convictions in one maximizing principle. In other words, that was, for me at least, his major argument against the ideas of what we call socialism and collectivism or others. So the point is that when Hayek derived at the idea to say that only the maximizing principle, the interdependence of the people, we are required to provide some sort of framework within which the people with different value convictions can exercise their maximizing principle without any interference from above. They can be interfered, of course, in certain groups and so on and so forth. That's, of course, quite clear. Therefore, he neglected and pushed aside that praxeological idea or praxeology as such, which Mises so hold so dearly. And he emphasized, in another word, in another very non-catching word, more the catalactic approach to economics. That was another, let me say, with all due respect, of course, another flop. No one takes on that word and especially gets excited on that. Of course, that did some disservice, I should say, with all clarity, to the development of the Austin School of Economics, especially in the 1950s and the 1960s. That is, for me at least, one of the reasons why it why there was not really a major development in the Austin School of Economics in the 1950s and the 1960s. More or less stagnant. You should not forget that most of the persons whom I called the fourth generation of the Austin School of Economics have even either been exported, to put it very slightly, or killed, or put under certain pressures where they became then, just to rescue their bare life, collaborators. So in other words, what was left in Austria proper and in continental Europe was, of course, no Austrian School of Economics. They were beginning to do certain other things, Hayek in London, Machlup in Buffalo, Habla in Harvard, and so on and so forth. They all developed that in different corners of the world. Of course, slightly, and I should not be misinterpreted here, in a slightly different way. I should say that the students of Hayek in England, the students of Mises in New York, the students of Machlup in Buffalo and later on Johns Hopkins or Princeton, of course, came from a different background, and they were not loaded with all that tradition which made these Austrians, and don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to do certain things here, put them in a different acceptance level. So that it was the reason why it became relatively calm around that thing. Hayek, Mises, and all others certainly were delivering Austrian economics, but they were engaged in different other, maybe day-to-day business and so on and so forth. Anyway, then in 1960, he developed published on his 60th birthday, probably, as I call it, the Magnus Opus, the Constitution of Liberty. I think that is unsurpassed. That's just an incredible piece of work. And out of that thing, there was a little bit of a renaissance coming up on the Austin School of Economics. Now, all of them more or less following Hayek's methodology. And that is, for me, a very important point. I should certainly then say a few words to the applicability of Hayek's interesting developments within the Austin School of Economics, especially with the linking, or the attempt to link his idea of the spontaneous order with economic and knowledge, or the use of knowledge in society problem. Spontaneous order is, of course, that thing what he meant by allowing people with different value convictions to allow their maximizing principle just to erupt, to unleash that thing. He got the idea that was told, he told me that by observing the side remarks Karl Menger made in his second book, The Principles of Economics, the methodological book. I forgot the English title. And the German title is almost two lines long. Unfortunately, that's another reason why no one takes up that book. Unfortunately, they are not great marketeers, by the way. So the point is that the spontaneous order he got from these glossarias Menger put on the side of his proofreading copy. And that was saying that out of the spontaneous unleashing of the market, you can see along the Ringstrasse in Vienna, people are beginning to become quite busy. It was the explanation of the boom. The boom for Hayek in that respect was, of course, then already playing a major role in his development of the business cycle theory, which is, of course, interlinked and interdependent on that thing. Hayek, in that respect, was, of course, quite consistent. I agree with Gary, very much so, that Hayek was, in his first, 20 years in academia, more or less a very close microeconomist, sure. On the other hand, all his ideas were already laid directly in front of us in his very early things. If you read, for instance, a tiny little piece which he published when he was still a socialist, 1918, everyone makes a mistake, so it's not really a big issue. He was even the founder of a socialistic student association together with another couple of very important names who all became very important members of the Mont Pelerin Society. So it's not a big deal. Everyone makes mistakes. So the thing is, what he published there was, of course, quite clear, the spontaneous interaction of all these things leading then to these ups and downs in the business cycle theory. The breakthrough, and I'm coming to my end, the breakthrough came in his foreword, and I certainly recommend to read these few pages in his collection of works, Collectivist Economic Planning, published in 1935. The foreword, the preface, is absolutely stunning, and you can see the whole thing on Hayek being clearly laid out in front of us. It is, for me, quite an interesting thing. Then let me repeat the ideas of that interdependency of orders certainly came then to total fruition with respect to the ideas of the so-called extended society, where the extended society, in his interpretation, certainly led to the spontaneous emergence of legal or ethical rules. That is what he then called these ups and downs, and therefore never accepting a total, the totality of values as such. Values are for him, and that is, as I said at the very beginning, of course, the act of an appraising mind, and therefore applied to the morality of things, applied to the efficiency of things, applied to all other things, it is, of course, quite clear that he must come to the evolutionary conclusion to say that law and the other things, the ethical rules guiding a society, must be seen as an evolution or as a spontaneous order. Final word, to wrap it up. When he, in the early 1960s, accepted his position at the University of Freiburg in Germany, he came, of course, into close contact with Ludwig Erhard and the Ordo members, were the members of the Ordo School in economics, especially Ludwig Erhard, Müller-Armack, and all other great members of the Mont Pelerin Society. It is an interesting thing that Ludwig Erhard, and I was an eyewitness, said to Hayek that why we called it the soziale Marktwirtschaft or the social market economy was only more or less a marketing strategy in order to have the word social market economy and everything else put together, and people seem to be really appealed by that. And immediately, Mr. Müller-Armack, everyone remembers him, jumped on Ludwig Erhard's neck as well as on Hayek's neck and said, no, the market must be made social in order to be a market in the first place. They got into a discussion, and of course, Hayek, gentle as he was, did not follow up. However, you can see on that tiny little conversation how deep the gap between the Ordo school, represented by Müller-Armack and others, and the Hayekian approach was. Final word, I think I have a great deal of evidence that the appointment of Hayek at the University of Freiburg was actually a mistake. People did not really know that he is an Austrian, because he is, for the first time in the history of economic thought, the first Austrian who has been appointed on a German chair, or a chair at a German university. And I can only say that's a mistake. Mr. Kiesinger, who was the governor of Baden-Württemberg at that particular time, I guess made a mistake. He thought he's an Ordo person, therefore, let's go. Thanks for your attention.
Sounds like a mistake worthy of Winston Churchill once meeting Isaiah Berlin and telling him how much he liked his music. I think you can imagine. It's another Isaiah Berlin. Well, we have time for a discussion again and questions, so as last time, yes.
Appreciate this very informed lecture. I have only two qualms with you, from what little I know. I agree with you that Hayek's magnum opus is the Constitution of Liberty. I fully agree. But as I understood what you said that that set off a little bit of a renaissance of Hayekian Austrian economics in the 60s. I accept the point that there was this renaissance in the United States of Austrian economics in the 60s, but I think that was primarily an influence of Mises, not Hayek. I don't think Hayek himself was the fountain of that. I think Mises, this Mises seminar, and out of that came Kirzner and all those people, that was essentially a Mises influence as opposed to Hayek influence. And I don't really think Hayek ever really triggered much of that Austrian influence. Of course, they incorporated Hayek, but I don't think he was the motivating force nearly as much as Mises. So I would disagree slightly with what you said there. And the second point I would make is, as you know, I disagree with you about the catalactics point. I think the catalactics is an extremely important conception and notion, and that's what we should be centering on in our methodology, what we should be talking about in economics. And I was a little bit taken back when you sort of dismissed that as a kind of a mistake, and that Hayek should not have used that.
May I respond?
Oh, yeah, sure. If you could explain to our lay people what the...
Okay. Jim, of course. The question, I think you're absolutely right as far as the United States are concerned. Absolutely right. I was more or less concentrating on that little bit of Renaissance in good old Europe. And that was not Misesian. That was more or less Hayek. We should not neglect the point that the Constitution of Liberty, as at least in excerpts, was already circulating more or less through the journal called Ordo. That was an important thing. Mises only published a few things. Hayek published more or less permanently on that thing, chapter after chapter out of his Constitution of Liberty. And he prepared more or less the turf for that. Furthermore, we should say that there was a very important and very courageous publisher in Switzerland, Eugen Rentsch. You have heard that. Eugen Rentsch Verlag outside Zurich, who really got into the business of publishing very, very awkward sounding, and I do not mean that in a demeaning way, titles by Hayek. Sagesse, for instance, Individualism, True and False. He crafted that a little bit different, and he published that book in German as wahrer und falscher Individualismus. Very important. That really caught on, especially, for instance, Hauptmann and others. Quite important. Mises was not really read, because he only published a very few things in German, and a very few things really got among the students. But Hayek was more present. So that, I think you, as far as the United States are concerned, and England, absolutely on your side, absolutely. And I apologize of having made the wrong impression that it was high. I only thought on the continental Europe. Because here there was more or less something going on anyway, but in continental Europe nothing was going on, actually, I should say. Since, as I said, we either killed our philosophers or exported them to your countries or made them silent or did some other things, and I could go on and on here. The Austrian School of Economics ceased to exist, more or less. So only with that incredible courage of that Mr. Eugen Rentsch in Switzerland, and Mr. Hunold to some degree, of course, that something was going on, and that should really be brought out. I am coming to my to your second point again. I certainly agree with you. What I meant to say was only that the term catalectic was not such as one should be turned on with. No one really understands that thing. Therefore, he tried hard, and I was actually part of that game. I really tried hard. We tingled around in Germany and talked to every second or third class university saying, okay, why don't they use the term catalactic? But it really didn't catch on. That was my idea. The ideas behind catalactic, you know that, that's absolutely ours, of course. But the term, he was really, really disappointed. He loved it.
Well, you'll never go broke underestimating the German need for terminology. Any other questions? I had a general one. It might be unfair to ask you, but since you were a student of Hayek's and you knew him so well, I wonder, since we're here at Chicago, did he have any general reflections on his time at the University of Chicago? Anything in particular that he thought he gained here or that he might have felt was important about his work while he was here?
He was very fond of Chicago. And I should add here immediately that his wife, Aunt Lenel, was equally fond of the intellectual, vibrant climate here in Chicago. There was no doubt. However, I should say, with all due respect, of course, that what he missed was that interdependence of ideas and orders, and he only enjoyed that, as you already pointed out, in his seminar. Further, to be more on a trivial side, was, of course, his problem, which he had since he was not on the payroll here. He forgot, sorry to say that, but he forgot to provide for his old age. And when he turned 60, he all of a sudden discovered that certainly he's not becoming younger, and his wife either. So all of a sudden he then rashly, more or less, accepted the offer from Germany. So it was not a dissatisfaction of the intellectual climate or the intellectuality of the United States overall, and in particular of Chicago. The main reason was just a trivial one.
He wasn't on the payroll as a faculty member? How did he live?
Out of funds collected by the Volcker Fund.
He was basically paid by a private foundation.
By the way, if I may say that, he shared that fate almost all over the world, wherever he was, like Mises. He did never ever get a full, very prestigious, which he would have deserved, of course, chair. Nothing. Pardon me?
Except in London.
Yes, that was his home. But he was young, flattered, of course, and so on and so forth. And for him, it was more or less a ray of hope, in other words. Don't forget, he was only paid, and I can tell you that, 5 Austrian shillings per month at the Institute for Business Cycle Research in Vienna. And he had already a young wife and could not live with an inflation rate of beyond 5,000-6,000%. So he really took that immediately and jumped, although his English was relatively mediocre at that particular time, as we all know.
Yeah. I'm sorry that Gary Becker left, because maybe we won't know the answer to this, but you know, Hayek has, while he was here, had a very different view, and certainly afterwards, on monetary economics than what the traditional Chicago school approach was. And in particular, one aspect that was very different had to do with the supply of money. Not on the demand side, but on the supply of money. Friedman always had the position that the central bank was in the fashion of a monopolist, and that there would be no limit unless the central bank limited the supply of money. And Hayek always took the position that money could be supplied as a private vehicle, and there was no need at all for a central bank. And I wonder, as a matter of historical doctrine, whether there was a clash here in Chicago during those years, because the Chicago monetary tradition is actually much older than Milton. It goes back certainly to Lloyd Mintz and to Henry Simons. And I'm wondering whether, you know, that ever came out in the open. I mean, you were a student. Did you ever express that?
Did not come out in the open, although he, on page 506 of the Constitution of Liberty, he already mentioned the idea of a concurrent currency. But everyone ignored that. Of course, who is reading notes in the back of the book? Yes, that was the idea. And don't forget, the idea was not really necessarily original by Hayek. The idea was already an old hat in the Austrian School of Economics. Gottfried von Strigel, for instance, already in 1932 argued about the demonopolization of the Federal Reserves, or the demonopolization of, as we call it in Austria, the Nationalbank. And therefore, I should, without any hesitation, say that when Hayek was offered the presidency of the Austrian National Bank, that was, of course, a mistake, I believe. He immediately, and I, I t- typed that letter, he immediately responded and said, now, since I am, or since my first action would be the demolition of that thing, I cannot accept that institution. That was very witty, I thought, at that particular time. As far as your question to be is concerned, and to be precise, I do not remember that it any time came up into the open. They were more concentrated on different other things.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the situation was such that when Hayek was here, the prevailing attitude toward Monith in Chicago, with the Mintz Simons tradition, and then from Milton coming in, it was so dominant in that view, and plus the fact, as you properly pointed out, Hayek had very little to do, or Gary pointed out, very little to do directly with the economics people, and especially in something like that. I think the Hayekian views on money and on the cycle really have come back very strongly, much more so in the 80s and 90s, with the sort of real business cycle theory coming back and the private money coming back. I mean, that's now a central part of money theory, but it surely was in the 50s and 60s. That simply wasn't taught.
That's absolutely
taboo. It was, if I may just add here, it was a kind of a funny thing when the Visa Corporation invited Hayek to give a talk at their Geneva convention. The two of us went there and we delivered that particular speech there, the concurrent currency. That was actually, when was it? I believe in 1977 or something like that. And all of a sudden, it became really something. But as I said, it's within the Austin School of Economics, an old idea. Even Menger talked about that.
We thank Professor Loiber very much for a nice paper and a very nice discussion.